This audio is of Heather Milton Lightning of the Indigenous Environmental Network addressing a National Shelter Sea meeting in Dublin. She's talking about the struggle against the extraction of tar sands in Canada. It was recorded November 2009. You can listen to more audio at the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.
This is Heather Milton Lightning from the campaign against the tar sands over in Alberta in Canada, and she can probably explain a lot more of it better than I can. So, that's Heather.
Hi, how are you doing? It's really nice to be here. Actually, I'm really excited about being here because we met folks from Rossport at Climate Camp when we brought a delegation over, and they invited us to come back. And unfortunately, I was the only one that could make it due to kind of financial restrictions. We have a really heavy schedule as far as like what we're doing in the UK right now. So that being said, I'm excited to be here. I'm glad to meet y'all. So how many people are familiar with what we're talking about, like tar sands? Have you heard about it before?
Yeah.
A little bit. Mm-hmm. So do you know what tar sand is?
Really dirty oil that comes out of sand.
Okay. Anyone else? Any ideas around tar sands development?
One of the most exploited, most ruinous exploitations of natural landscape, natural environment.
So it's kind of along the same lines that you were talking about. Like it's bitumen. It's that's what they call it, and they call it tar sands because it's a mixture of sand and clay. And there's a couple different ways that they go about trying to get it out of the earth. They've known about it since probably 1940, 1950. And it was Shell's actually been involved for a long time. I would say since probably about 1950. 1979, I believe, was the first time that they started actually developing tar sands. So it goes back quite a long time. It was very intentional. Native people, of course, always knew what it was. We used it for different things. Because, it's on the riverbanks, you could see it. But it wasn't, the idea wasn't to go ahead and develop it or anything like that. It was just something that coexisted with us. So there's a couple different processes. Anybody familiar with in situ mining? Anybody heard of that? So tar sands is, it's not clean. It's a mixture of different things. So what they do is they shoot steam into the earth to heat up the tar sands to make it a sludge so they can suck it out. And they use a huge amount of water and a huge amount of energy in order to do that. They do open pit mining. To give you an idea right now, like the tar sands development currently is about the size of England in northern Alberta. And the open expansion last summer to do research to see if they could viably get tar sands development in Saskatchewan, which is a neighboring province. So it's going to expand. To give you some background, like Alberta has been doing conventional oil and gas for a very long time. Native people have been involved in that process on and off. But it's really, really dirty project. And the thing that is really kind of frustrating, it's one thing to go in and, open pit mine or do in situ or these other processes to pull out the bitumen. It has to be upgraded. It needs natural gas in order to be pulled out and to go through a refining process to actually make it into like crude oil, right? And so that whole process takes a lot of energy. They're proposing 12 nuclear reactors for Alberta right now. They're creating natural gas pipelines from Alaska down to the tar sands, which is going to destroy pristine water systems all the way up into the Arctic. Because in Alberta, we're right here. Alaska's over here, but that watershed, the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, or the Mackenzie Valley watershed, it all feeds into the Arctic. And so it's going to ruin that whole watershed, and it's pristine water, drinkable water. And I think the thing that is really frustrating about it is that they're proposing all these pipelines. So there's one that's going to go west through British Columbia, and they're going to develop a port there and ship oil down to California to be refined, but also to China. There's going to be another pipeline that they're developing right now that's going to go through Canada, through Minnesota, down to Chicago, and to other refinery communities that are already there. So if you know anything about the Great Lakes, these are areas that have been developed for refineries. The unfortunate thing is that a lot of the communities around there are already living in refinery communities. They're already polluted, but what they're going to do is they have to upgrade those refineries in order to process bitumen. So there's a whole bunch of different people along those pipelines, and in the tar sands, they're fighting back. But the tar sands pipelines also extend north and south. So in order to get that natural gas, it has to come down all the way from Alaska all the way down through the Mackenzie Valley pipeline into Alberta. And then they're going to ship it all the way down to places like Chicago, to Oklahoma, and then down to the Gulf of Mexico. So it's this huge, like, tentacle kind of octopus that reaches out in a whole bunch of different ways. It's going to involve nuclear, natural gas, and any other kind of energy source in order to refine the oil. What's really been frustrating is that Canada has this agreement with the United States. Like, in essence, we're really like the golden gluttonous cow as far as energy and resources, precious minerals, logging, you name it, any kind of resource that can be extracted, it generally goes to the U.S. We don't really necessarily see it in Canada. We don't necessarily benefit from it. So because of NAFTA and other agreements, we have a certain amount of percentage of energy that has to at all times go to the States, and we have to meet that quota. And it's an agreement that we're locked into right now. And so tar sands is kind of looked at as energy security for the U.S. The majority of that oil and gas is not going to be used in our country. It's going to be shipped out. We don't actually have any of that kind of security for Canada, really, essentially. So it's kind of interesting that we're being completely bombarded with development that isn't even going to benefit our own folks. So that being said, we went through that whole process of trying to fight all these big, you know, free trade agreements and so on. And I think the rest of the world went through that process too. It's very unfortunate. But it's such a huge development, and one of the things that we've really tried to propose is to work with Native communities, but all along the pipeline corridors, around the refinery communities, and really trying to look at a way to fight back, that we can win this campaign. So interestingly enough, that pipeline goes to a small community called Leech Lake in Minnesota, and there are 5 people in that community that are fighting back against this pipeline. And they've convinced Sierra Club to fund them to sue the State Department, in particular Hillary Clinton, because she signed the agreement about bringing this pipeline across the border. And so it's 5 people that are fighting in that community. We're working with folks in BC, like a lot of the communities in BC where this pipeline is going to go through have already said no. We don't want to consult with you. We don't want your companies to come visit us. We don't want the government to consult with us. We don't want the pipeline. We're saying no right from the beginning. So, in Alaska, it's the same kind of thing. Alaska, because of the permafrost melting, climate change, and so on, it's just an open zone now for natural gas, all different kinds of resource development. And one of our staff, who recently created her own organization, which is called Red Oil, they actually just won an offshore drilling campaign against Shell and kicked them out of their territory. And so that's really huge for us to see small communities in Alaska fight back and win. So this is our campaign, essentially. You can have one of these stickers if you want. But the idea is, I don't know if you're familiar with treaty process and, you know, First Nations rights and Aboriginal rights in Canada, but essentially what it means is that because we're recognized as the original people in Canada legally, right now we're the only people in Canada that can legally stop development. And so our campaign is really trying to work with First Nations and empower them, but also like to think about litigation strategies that can stop the Canadian government from doing this. To sue the Alberta government and so on. And so some of those campaigns have been really effective, some litigation has been really effective. But because we're the ones that can only legally do that in Canada, it's one of the things that we're really trying to elevate within the larger environmental movement, that they really need to work with Native people because we're the only ones that can effectively do that. So I'll pass these around. You can take one if you like. So essentially, we're working with a lot of different folks. The big frustration is, I don't know if you've heard recently, but we've gone through a recession process in the U.S. and Canada. So the way it impacted us, though, around tar sands is that there was a lot of smaller Canadian, smaller companies that were developing tar sands. Unfortunately, when the recession happened, it wasn't economically viable. And so what ended up happening with these companies, they got bought out by the big transnationals. And so, you know, in a campaign scenario, if you're fighting a smaller country company, it's a lot easier to shut them down. And when you're fighting a big transnational, it gets a lot more difficult because they have a lot more rights than a smaller country-based company. And so we've seen this process happen. You know, and the politics are really, really, really complex. You know, a lot of the Native communities have contracts with the companies. And that it's one of those things where you're kind of forced into a corner, where the companies are going to force you to do it. You have to make the choice. And obviously you're going to end up, you know, signing in with these companies, whether or not you want to or not. But the unfortunate thing is that it's had a huge devastating impact. One of the communities that's 100 kilometers downstream from most of the development is Fort Chip. It's one of the oldest settlements in Alberta. It's a trading community. There's Dene and Cree First Nations people there, and also Métis. But we're seeing high elevated levels of cancer. The people are dying because of this development. The Alberta government will not acknowledge that it's due to tar sands development. The Canadian government has denied it. Industry, of course, doesn't want anything to do with it. And the community, it's just a really hard position for them to be in because they do have contracts. There are all these political things to think about and economics and so on. And this is a community where there's no roads. You have to fly in. You can only drive in on the river systems in the wintertime when the ice is frozen. You know, the cost of living there is really expensive. And so it's kind of like, you know, you need the money from the tar sands development in order to live. You know, and the fiduciary responsibility of the government is not all that great in the sense of, like, really giving us what we were entitled to as far as our treaty rights. So it gets really complex at that point. But one of the things that they've done is launched litigation. Mikisew has been really successful, which is the Cree community. Athabasca Chipewyan is the Dene community that's there. They've been really, really vocal in the last couple years around asking for a moratorium on tar sands development. So, you know, they're a community that for the last, up to about, I'd say, 10 years ago, was a subsistence community, like 80%, which means that they lived off the fish, the moose, you know. They lived off the natural environment. But now what we're seeing is that there's tumors in the moose, the muskrats, they'll find them with their noses bleeding. The fish have tumors and lesions on their bodies. And, of course, you know, what industry and what the government says is they have to, like, preserve these animals with the tumors to prove it, right, and to get testing done and so on. And, you know, like, any average hunter that's a subsistence person isn't going to have the ability to, you know, package up these fish the way the science wants it and so on. So it's been really frustrating because the animals and the plants and everything else are toxic. The water's toxic. They're dumping about 2 liters per second of effluent into the water system. And, you know, the Alberta government has really low standards as far as the regulatory process for environmental impacts in northern Alberta around tar sands. And, of course, like, you know, the Alberta government benefits from all this development, right? And so obviously they're going to have low standards because they want the money and they want everything to work out. And they have a $25 million PR campaign globally that talks about how great they are and how wonderful they are. And just to give you a broader sense, like when we came over here to the UK, we did a lot of media and it had some really big impacts. And I kind of think it's funny that they have a $25 million campaign, but like 5 of us being here and talking to media had a big impact. So it's kind of ironic, the ability of being able to reach out to folks strategically, particularly in the media, it's been really useful. And the reason why we came to the UK in particular and to Europe, there's been trips to Norway with Statoil, to Paris with Total Fina, to other different companies that have ties to tar sands development. And the reason being is that Canada really cares what Europe thinks about it. And, you know, everybody thinks that Canada is a really great place to live. We have really great human rights standards. And, you know, we have Aboriginal people that have great rights and all these other things, but that's not necessarily the case. And so when we came here and we started talking about how destructive this development was and asking the UK BP to pull out of their development, putting China put pressure on Shell, targeting the financial institutions here that are funding tar sands, the Royal Bank of Scotland is one of them. They're about the 11th... They're not number one, but they're about number 11 as far as how much money they're throwing into tar sands development currently. So that's been one of the things that we've been trying to make ties around is who's invested globally and how do we connect with the activist community that are involved in fighting climate change, but also just generally have the same rhetoric that we do and can help us out. And I think that's one of the things where I see there's definite parallels around the work that you're doing with Shell and some of the work that's happening globally, but also in North America with Indigenous people and how we're trying to target Shell as well, in particular with Alaska and Red Oil and what they did with their campaign and how they kicked Shell out of offshore drilling. So, you know, those are kind of the things that we would be willing to share. You know, we're rolling into Copenhagen. We're going to be doing actions there globally around energy. We're going to be doing action around tar sands and just different other things to try and highlight within the climate change negotiations that they have to respect Indigenous peoples' rights in that framework. So we've really been trying to go global with it for quite a long time. We've had Indigenous people come to these different international systems, World Social Forums or other places that we also go and send delegations to. Like, we try and reach out to as many people as possible. I think the big difference between our organization and others in Canada and the U.S. is that our organization was formed at a spiritual gathering in 1990 at Bear Butte in South Dakota. And Bear Butte is a sacred place to, I can say, about 70 different tribes. And at the time, before 1990, like the big end of goes, like Greenpeace and Sierra Club and so on, they'd find out that there was an issue in a community, right? And they'd come out to our community and take pictures of us, and they'd talk with us, and they'd do all these different things. But at the end of the day, they would leave, and they'd develop a campaign, and they'd fundraise, and they'd do all these things, and run a campaign, and have no accountability to the community, ever, in that process. And our organization formed because we wanted to be able to provide a mechanism so our people could speak for themselves, develop their own campaigns. And kind of this idea about environmental justice, IAN's been involved in that work for a long time. And so that's the same with the tours that we've brought people from impacted communities to talk about tar sands development, to put a face to the issue. And that's kind of the way we feel about the climate negotiations as well. Like, a lot of times these people that are negotiating on behalf of companies, on behalf of governments, they don't see the people that are directly impacted, and they need to. They need to be reminded that they're violating human rights, they're violating all these things, and they're killing our people. And essentially that's why we go there. We go there to put a human face to the issue, because we really feel like that's an important and a viable way to be really active within that corporate United Nations kind of entity. So those are some of the strategies that we're doing. We're also working with the broader environmentalist movement in Canada, which is, I would say, 10 years behind the United States in understanding environmental justice and how that kind of works out. We've been able to get Native people that are from the impact regions of the tar sands hired with Greenpeace, with the Rainforest Action, so these big, large environmental organizations, and that's taken a long time. And I think that goes back to this idea of we need to speak for ourselves. If there's funding campaigns that happen, they need to be accountable to First Nations people. And that's kind of the agenda that we've always pushed around this work. It's just really, you know, highlighting grassroots community organizing as the solution to a lot of this work. You know, and even in the sense of, like, Greenpeace and how they do actions and RAN and these other organizations and how they do nonviolent direct action, like, we really feel like that needs to happen from a community level as well. Because a lot of times people want to get involved and they think it's really great and they want to be really passionate about it. But again, they're doing actions on behalf of and they're not working with us. And I think that's the big difference, where we see things a lot different. We want to come here and work with people. We don't want to work on behalf of anybody. And we see strategic alliances in certain ways. And I think the other thing that's really been a challenge is that a lot of the communities that are in the pipelines and the corridors, like sometimes it's the whole community that are saying no. Sometimes it's one family or one person. And we've been trying to work with these folks to really elevate their issues, but also, you know, connect them to other folks that are working on the same thing and that feel the same way. Because I feel like a lot of times, like if you're in Fort Chip and you're trying to fight this, it's really isolating, especially if the community doesn't know where they're at politically around this stuff, or they don't have the education or the capacity to build an organization or to build a campaign. And so that's kind of some of the work that we do, is to bring together community members that are going through the same kind of issues. And we like to do that globally as well. So those are some of the strategies that we've been thinking through. We've been working internationally with groups like the Durban Group, with Oil Watch, a whole bunch of different environmental organizations. What's unfortunate right now is that there's a movement in Canada by different environmental organizations, industry and the government to start doing carbon trading in Canada. And recently they just created this document without a lot of our own people at the table saying what they would endorse around carbon trading. And basically, in essence, it means that this is our prediction, is that before Copenhagen they're going to release to the world that they're creating a system to solve the problem around the tar sands, because Canada was a signatory to Kyoto. And because of the tar sands, we're never going to meet those requirements ever. It's just not going to happen. There's just so much emissions. It's just so destructive. It's just not going to happen. And it's to the point where it's actually, this project is so big, it's the tipping point for that kind of carbon emission. Like, it's a global issue just because of that, and in this idea of climate change. But what's really frustrating is they're proposing that with carbon trading, they can continue to develop. And so it's this idea that they'll buy a protected area or a forest over here and they'll get the carbon credits for it, but that doesn't mean they have to ever stop developing, right? And so if they go ahead and develop this area, they can do reclamation, which there's no science behind, but they'll do it, and the Canadian government will endorse it. And so if they do reclamation, they restore the site to the certain standards, that means that they can go into that protected area and to develop it later on. And so it's kind of like this checkerboard of industry. And it's really being sold really well in Canada to a lot of different people, and it's really frustrating that environmental organizations are saying yes to it. I mean, our people really feel like anything that's a market-based solution is not going to solve our problems. It's not going to mitigate the cancer. It's not going to solve the problems around the environment and the devastation to the watersheds, to the air. I mean, we have acid rain. There's just so many problems. It goes on and on because it's so huge. So those are the kind of things that we're rolling into Copenhagen with. We're going to have a really strong voice around Indigenous rights, but around carbon trading and around, you know, just trying to hold the companies and the governments accountable to what we're doing. So we've been working with a lot of folks all over the globe. And one of the things that the Liberal Democrat Party in the UK is thinking about is creating an international treaty to ban tar sands development. Because the thing about it is that Alberta has this huge deposit, but there's tar sands in Colorado in the United States. There's tar sands in South America. There's tar sands in the Congo. And so we're kind of like the test zone to develop the technology to, you know, extract tar sands. And so if they can do really great with this project, they're going to go global with it. And so that's one of the things that we're hoping we can see organizations and people sign on to, this idea of a treaty to ban tar sands development. There was a treaty that we worked on, I would say about 10 years ago, and it was a long, long campaign against persistent organic pollutants. But that was also an international treaty that got recognized, and those kind of chemicals were actually, there was an international ban created globally on them. And that took a lot of work, but I just feel like it's a way for people to actually sign on to something and endorse something in their own countries and in their own communities around tar sands development. So I don't know if people have questions.
Sorry, just a point of information. Mm-hmm. We're not part of the UK, so mm-hmm. there's a difference in terms of...
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. Right. But I think the whole point of it is that we're excited about the international ban and mm-hmm. that they're proposing it within their own government, because it's not something that necessarily we could do in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And for us, it's strategic because, you know, like I said, there's so many places that have tar sands. And for us, it's a way to get this global voice and other folks involved. And it's really strategic for us because it just having another country and having other people involved in the work that we're doing and also saying that they're against it is really strategic. It helps us elevate the tar sands globally, and that's really important for people within the media, but within the organizing work, to understand how big this development is and to sign on to it. I think it can be really effective, at least from an organizing sort of standpoint. Right. Anybody else? Sorry.
Well, first of all, I think you've done a pretty good job so far getting the word out. Like,
mm-hmm.
I consider it as the most, like, that it's come across as the most destructive project in the world, and that, you know. I just question, like, how big is the area, and then how do you, I suppose you touched on it a bit, but how do you network between all the community groups, like, if it's such a big area, you know?
It's been really challenging because I think there's only a few communities that have officially, like within the media and publicly, come out and said that they want a moratorium or they want to stop development as far as First Nations are concerned. It's really complex just because of the fact that we have people coming from all over Canada to work in these companies. Like Newfoundland, for example, in the eastern provinces, most of the men that live in Newfoundland actually work in the tar sands, so they're gone for a month at a time. We also have a foreign temporary worker program that brings in workers from other countries. They get paid like next to nothing and have no rights. So there's all these different layers of things. And because a lot of communities won't publicly come out and say that they're against tar sands development, they'll support other communities behind closed doors and say, like, we want you to move ahead with this, but they won't necessarily come out and, like, run a campaign. And I think the difficulty is that, you know, there was leadership in the past in different communities that did sign agreements with the companies, you know, and the community might not have agreed with it, but that's what happened. And so, in essence, they're kind of locked into some pretty particular positions. Where they have contracts, they have an agreement with the government, and so on. So it makes it really difficult. But I think one of the things that is really hopeful is we're seeing different kinds of movements happening. There's a group called the Keepers of the Athabasca Watershed Council, and it's a group of farmers, First Nations, Métis, folks in the whole watershed that are starting to come together around water issues. And that's the way they're framing it. And I actually got to go on a tour with them. And it was really interesting to go to communities that are very conservative, but talk to them about the sacredness of water and how it's a human right. And then they started talking about tar sands, and then they started talking about what they were seeing in their own water systems, the impacts of, like, all the different tar sands capacities because it's so big. So that's been a really effective strategy in thinking about, like, how allies work together. But like I said, it's really complex. A lot of times there's leadership in communities that sign agreements that the grassroots doesn't agree with. But there's no recourse for that. And, like, if it's a legally binding agreement, then it makes it really difficult to rescind on it, which is part of the problem as well. I think the other thing is that if people aren't publicly willing to come out against it, it makes it difficult. To give a good example, like in Saskatchewan, we have a huge uranium deposit there, and they did open pit uranium mining back in the day, and there was a lot of Native people that carried uranium out of these mines on their backs. There's whole communities that are radioactive now that you can't live in. But they've kind of slowed down on that uranium development to a degree right now. But the uranium companies have bought out everybody. Like, they have built roads. They donate to the hospitals. They donate to the schools. Like, they're everywhere. And they're so entrenched in everything. And First Nations, you know, First Nations have their own uranium company in Saskatchewan. Like, there's three-quarters ownership of that company. And so if there's families, there's a few families within that uranium development zone that have said they're really against uranium development, but they're scared to come out and say something. Like, that's a reality, too, that there are places where it's not safe to be against development. And until we can build a broader movement and involve more people in saying no, I don't ever want to put somebody in a position where their safety, their economic viability is threatened. Because I don't think that's fair to a family to say, like, go ahead and say no to development, we'll support you, but we can't be there every day and ensure that the police don't beat you up or your own people don't beat you up or, you know, you don't get threatened by police. You know what I mean? So it just, it's all over the map. It's really complex. But there are communities that we are working with that have said no, and we're trying to network with those folks.
Just, I had a stereotype that, like, Canada had, like, really good green policy, like, uh-huh. Everybody was liberal and everybody was, like, ate from the health food stores. So I'm very surprised by that. Has it, like, got, like, next to no environmental protection, or...?
Well, in the case of Alberta, our standards are really low. They could be 10 times higher. Like, to give you an example, there's a rural municipality of Wood Buffalo, and that's, like, one of the big areas. Like, Fort Chip is in that region. There's a lot of tar sands development in that region. But for that region, there's two environmental officers that are responsible for the whole area, and they are not there every day. They rotate and they check in. The duty of reporting on any environmental, like, spills, any environmental issues is on the company. It's not on Environment Canada, and that's a huge issue because they can say whatever they want, and the Canadian government will say, okay, that's cool, or the Alberta government will say, that's great. Like, to give you an idea, like, there's so much effluent being poured into the Athabasca, but there's also these big tar sands ponds, these tailings ponds, because they're so polluted, and you can't put them back into the water. You can't do anything with them. So they just put them, like, they line plastic, or they'll do whatever they can that they say is, like, good technology. But you can see these tailings ponds from space. And they're not ponds, they're like lakes. But last year, we have migratory birds, and a lot of people from Port Chip eat ducks and goose and swans and so on. And so they were on their way back up north, as they always do. And there were 1,600 ducks that landed in one of these tar sands ponds, and two of them survived, and they tried to clean them up, and they all died. Like, those two ended up dying because, like, the oil and the toxins are so mm-hmm. devastating. But that's to give you an example of, like, how big it is that 1,600 ducks died. And what they reported in the newspapers when it got out was that, like, 500 of them died, when the numbers are a lot bigger. Like, there's bears and moose and other wild animals that get into these tar sands ponds. And what they do is they have these cannons, and they have these, like, dummy scarecrow people that are supposed to scare away the bird. And they think that that's effective.
Big signs up all over the place.
But, like, shouldn't that... it's stupid. But that's the way the Canadian and the Alberta government has said, like, that's how we'll regulate the tar sands ponds. Right. We'll just shoot off the cannons more often. Mm. You know what I mean? And it's on the companies to be responsible for those cannons and to report on it. It's not on the responsibility of Environment Alberta.
Knowing very little about, like, tar sands is, like, a vital environment. It would be, like, something that was thriving, like, with wildlife if it wasn't being exploited.
Yeah, I mean, it's been there for a long, long time. Like I said, Native people have always known it was there. We used it to, like, pitch, like, our canoes and other things like that. But it wasn't, like, exploited for development in that sense, right? Yeah. I think that's as far as I'll go with that one.
Have you used much direct action in your campaign, blockades, things like that?
From a community standpoint, not really.
Okay.
The reason why is that, like I said, things are complex, and people are still in the communities, even having conversations about organizing. Like, they're not at the level where you're seeing community-based organizing happening yet. And I think it's irresponsible to do direct action when the people are not ready for it. What's unfortunate, though, is that the big NGOs have done a lot of direct action, And the community's response to that is that's great, it's bringing a lot of media attention and so on. The bad part about it, though, is that because of Homeland Security laws now, there was 3 big Greenpeace actions this fall. They may be getting charged with terrorism laws, and that changes the game for direct action in Canada. Like if you have a conspiracy to be a terrorist and so on, like that changes the way direct action is going to have to happen. The unfortunate thing was is that they went into the companies and they shut down one of the mining companies for like 8 hours. And they were there for like 32 hours. And I think that's great. That's a great action. But the only problem was it wasn't people from tar sands. There were a lot of international Greenpeace activists that came from other places to do these actions on behalf of tar sands. It wasn't led by the communities. It wasn't endorsed by the communities. And at the end of the day, the companies have now changed the way they do security. And so Native people used to be able to go check their chap lines or go to their cabins or like get into the site with no problem. And that was one of the things that we were relying on, is that different Native folks could just walk in and go check things out and report back to them, to the communities, but also different environmental organizations, and kind of scout things out. So we had a sense of what was going on and what was truthful and what they were reporting and what wasn't. And so now we don't have the ability to do that. And so if First Nations are going to go ahead and do actions, or community-based organizations are going to go ahead and do direct action, it's going to be a lot different. It's going to have a lot of different impacts. And so that's something that's unfortunate, that these big NGOs don't take responsibility for, and it's been a real frustration.
What you're saying, on the legal front, you were saying that the Aboriginal people are the ones that are able to enforce a lot of these claims in court. Just on that front, do you have legal teams, or have you got are people reading up on law themselves? Are they empowering themselves in that way as well, or do you have voluntary legal people, or is it a mix? Or
it kind of depends on the community. Like Beaver Lake right now is involved in the litigation, and the company that's funding them is actually a financial institution in the UK. So they're funding their whole litigation process. But the thing about it is that, like, for example, ACFN just recently lost their court case. They're appealing it, but they lost the first initial go around, and it had to do with environmental impact assessment that the companies have to do. And they give you a 90-day period to respond to it. And it was against Shell. And so here's ACFN with their lawyers, and then Shell with like 40 fucking lawyers at the table, right? I'm swearing, but it's like they have their team of 40 lawyers versus like our 2 lawyers that we can barely pay for, right? And sometimes there'll be environmental organizations or funders that will front the bills for it. Sometimes the First Nations have the ability to pay for some of it themselves. But that's not necessarily always the case. Like, if they're going to go into an appeals process, we still got to find the money to pay for that. So it kind of depends on the community, and it kind of depends on what they're... Like, some are infringing, saying they're infringing on their treaty rights. Some are saying they're infringing on their traditional territory. Some are saying they didn't properly have the duty to consult. And so when we talk about prior informed consent at the UN level, the Canadian government is responsible to consult with First Nations people on any kind of development, and that consultation has to be done in a way that makes sense for First Nations. And so when the industry comes and tries to consult with us around issues, that's not good enough. And that's definitely what's happened, and that's why ACFN ended up suing, was because of around this idea of duty to consult. The Canadian government didn't do it. So, sorry.
ACFN.
The Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, which is the Dene community that's in Fort Chipewyan and in the surrounding region. Sorry.
They are a little bit vague, but like, thinking that the ice caps melting is like one of the biggest fears like going on right now, isn't mm-hmm. it? To have like something that is directly impacting on that environment, if I'm getting like the picture right, like how far up like the network of the network of gas pipes, whatever, like going up into the Antarctic, is that like something that like a lot of people have reacted on? Like, I mean,
I wouldn't really say so in that framework. I think one of the things that's difficult is just. The development is going on, behind closed doors. You know, these agreements are happening behind closed doors. The general public doesn't really know about it. We find out about things after the fact. And when it comes to the pipeline corridors and so on, like there's been, it's interesting with the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, which goes directly up north into Alaska. It's been elders and young people that have said no to that pipeline. But the leadership and the people that are actually able on the table to meet with government, with industry, are the folks that have the power to make the decisions. So it's really been interesting. Like, they were really successful at stopping the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline from coming through. But it was the mobilization of the older folks and the younger people that were really effective at doing it. So it's just, it kind of depends on the communities in that region, how they fight back. But it's not necessarily the direct impact on, like, the ice caps melting and so on. Because those pipelines are not necessarily completely built yet. They're not all shipping oil yet. But that's where we're trying to stop them. Like, for example, in Minnesota with the Enbridge or Alberta Clipper. So that's the one that's coming from Fort McMurray across Canada down to Minnesota all the way to Chicago. Basically, if the Leech Lake folks, those five people, if they're going to be effective at stopping Enbridge from coming through their community, that delays that pipeline for 3 years, 2 to 3 years. In that 2 to 3 year time period, the pipeline that they've already laid is going to rust out. It's going to cost them billions of dollars to replace all that pipeline, plus to actually do all the environmental assessments, to get the approvals from everyone else, to buy out all the land, to reconstruct and go around that First Nations community. And so some of the tactics are not always like to stop it immediately, but to do delay tactics until we can figure out another way around it and mobilize more people. So I don't know if that particularly answered your question, but I was trying to.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
There was another thing, like you were talking about, like water reservoir, like the target reservoirs. Mm-hmm. Just totally reminded me of like what was happening on Bowen and Boy before like it got built, like the way that like water was being stored or like got rid of on the place, which mm-hmm. was like all like plastic lined.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's stupid technology, and they're trying to tell people that it doesn't leak. It totally leaks. We have evidence that it leaks, and it leaks into the groundwater. Like it's just so unbelievable that they can get away with saying this stuff publicly because we know better, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just really frustrating. But I think the one thing that I forgot to share is that, like, our study as far as, like, Shell development is that Shell has had such a hard time from community-based organizations, from folks fighting back against their development, that now they're divesting a lot of their financial resources into tar sands development.
Right.
And that's because everybody else on the planet has been really effective at fighting Shell. So that's something to know and to be really happy about. But what's unfortunate for us is that more money from Shell going into tar sands development. But, you know, like I said, you know, we have a lot of hope. I mean, the folks in Alaska being able to kick Shell out is a big victory for us. The fact that the five people in fighting Enbridge Clipper are suing the State Department is really huge. The fact that the communities in BC have outright said no to the pipelines right from the beginning is really, really big. And, you know, we're trying whatever we can. Like, the Olympics are coming up. We have a financial campaign through RAND against the Royal Bank of Canada, and they're the biggest investors in tar sands, but they're also the biggest investors in the Olympics. And so we're trying to make all the parallel links that we can out there to get the message out about tar sands. And I think it's been really effective.
Just had, like, totally down a thought there about, like, how Shell have had, like, 100 years of practice of dealing with things. And, like, for every step back they've got probably another way of dealing with things, a bit more practice. And hopefully, like, we and you and the people of the planet are going to win out over these individuals.
Here, here. Where in Alaska did the Shell be built?
It's the southern part. It's a bay. And I'm too tired to actually think clearly. But the organization is called Red Oil. And the woman that was instrumental in moving forward with that, her name's Faith Gimmel. She's been involved in fighting oil development since she was like a teenager, like against that ANWR, the Alaska Natural Wildlife Refuge. She was really involved in that for a long time, and she's the one who really moved ahead in mobilizing Native people in Alaska with this network. So she's been really successful and really excited about her. She's an amazing person. So the other thing that I was going to propose too is that it sounds like folks from the UK are going to be coming over to Tar Sands. It sounds like some reporters might come over, and it would be really cool if folks from here that are involved with Rossport stuff would be interested in coming and meeting with some of the Tar Sands folks. Just know that you have the invitation to come and meet with our folks at home. We'd be happy to meet with you.
Will there be a lot of people involved in the Tar Sands stuff in Copenhagen?
I'm hoping so. I'm really hoping so. We're actually hoping to do like some kind of direct action that's Tar Sands specific, that's going to be led by Indigenous folks from that region. But we don't know what it looks like yet. Like next, when am I leaving? Wednesday, I'm going to Copenhagen to do the scouts for those actions. And so we've been meeting with like the climate camp folks, rising tide folks, whoever we can, to like try and help us figure out. I think the big thing is like trying to figure out like the legal question over there. Because that's kind of, for us, the make it or break it around a lot of these actions. Like, we don't necessarily want our community-based folks to get arrested. That's just, it's not something that we're really into. Like, to be honest with you, in any direct action, like, it's just not a good thing for us to get arrested. Because at least in Canada, like, they're pretty darn racist. And, you know, like, to have our folks be thrown in there is just not... It's not the best case scenario for us. And it happens. I mean, KI has been fighting Platnix, and all five of their leadership got thrown in jail for 9 months for doing direct action from time to stop a diamond company from coming into their lands. And so, like, that was huge. But, you know, if we have to do it, we'll do it. And I think that's the big difference that me and we were talking about, is that we don't do this because we care about, like, the environment, or we have a passion for the environment. We do this because we don't have any choice. You know, like, we're in a corner, our way of life is dying, our people are dying. We do this because we have to. You know, like, I don't know, like, that's why I'm saying, like, the arrestable situation is not the best for us. You know, like, we don't want to be in armed occupations, we don't want to be in these situations, but if we have to, we will. And that's what it comes down to, you know. So, kind of sucks, but I have a lot of hope, you know. The reason why I say that is that, like, we've been through, 150 years of colonialism. Our people have been attacked and oppressed in every single way that you could possibly think of, and we've survived. We still have our languages and our ceremonies intact. We still have our way of life intact, and if we can survive that, we will survive the Tar Sands. That's just the nil of it. Our people are that strong. And I really believe that about y'all's too, is that, you know, like, y'all are from here, you have a connection to where you're from, you'll survive it too. And so hopefully, like, we'll come out of this with a much different vision about how to move forward with the way things happen on this planet. Sweet.
Thank you, Heather.
Thanks, Ray. Thank you very much.
This audio is of Heather Milton-Lightning of the Indigenous Environmental Network addressing a National Shelter Sea meeting in Dublin. She's talking about the struggle against the extraction of tar sands in Canada. It was recorded November 2009. You can listen to more audio at the WSM website at www.wsm.ie.